Beloved hearers of God's word, grace and peace to you from the one who was, who is, and who is to come. Amen. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far away when I cry to you? So we hear the call of the psalmist this morning and the cry that Jesus uttered in his last moments on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? And then there's Job. Today my complaint is bitter. God's hand is heavy. Oh, that I knew where I might find God, that I might come even to his dwelling. If I go forward, he's not there. Or backward, I can't perceive him. On the left side, God hides. I cannot behold God. I turn to the right, but I cannot see God there. God has made my heart faint, and the Almighty has terrified me. Shall we just cut right to the chase? How many of us here have felt that way before? My God, where are you? In the midst of life's journey, there is no one who makes it through without suffering, hardship, without loss or grief. And in those moments, it's often said we draw nearer to God as we are strengthened and consoled. But we need to be honest in a church. We are often just as likely in those moments to pull away from God, to feel ourselves utterly abandoned by our God. If you have felt this way, if you have experienced this, if you at this moment are here experiencing that, I want to tell you, you are not alone. Sometimes we look around and we think everybody else has got it figured out, and I'm the only one who's here today wondering, where are you, God? Who are you, God? Why has this happened? But if we pay attention to our scriptures, we find time and time and time again good, faithful people trying to do all the right things who find themselves suffering hardship and trials, challenges, devastation, in fact, at times. It's important, I think, for us to remind ourselves that 40% of the Psalms, that is 60 out of 150, 40% of the Psalms have to do with loss and grief and lament and this calling out, where are you, God? That feeling of the absence of God. The book of Job is dedicated in its entirety to that question. And if you have never read it, I encourage you to take a couple hours sometime and sit down and read your way through it. It begins in a very kind of bizarre way. You have God in the kind of heavenly throne room. You have these heavenly beings that are coming and going. And amongst them, who comes to join him but Satan? In fact, in the Hebrew, ha-satan, which means the accuser. It's like the mayor or the premier, the president, the prime minister. It is the definite article. It is someone who represents a whole kind of larger network. The accuser comes in and sits next to God, and they kick back in their easy chairs. And they observe all of the world. And God leans over and says to Satan, "Have you seen my boy Job? My servant, I am so proud of him. He is a good man, a faithful man, an honest man. He takes care of his family, takes care of all of those in his household. He's devoted to me completely. I couldn't love him anymore." And we have Satan, who's kind of scratches his wiry beard and looks, says, "Yeah, okay. But you have given him everything he has ever wanted in life. You've just handed it over to him. Of course he loves you. Of course he's going to be faithful to you. Just start taking some things away from him, though. Just start messing with the things that he loves in life." And Satan says, "I bet he'll turn on you so fast, you won't know what happened. He will curse your name." So then it's God's turn to kind of consider that for a moment and scratch his own, I guess, giant beard, if we're going with those images, and say, "Okay, Satan, I'm intrigued. So here's the deal. You get to go down and mess with Job's life. You get to start taking things away from him. And we'll see what happens. All I ask," God says, "all I demand is that you do not kill him." And so begins the book of Job, where a good man who's done all the right things, and in fact who God couldn't be more proud of, starts to lose the things in his life that mean so much to him. First, it's land, possessions and servants. Then a house collapses upon all of his children and takes them. In that, he continues to say, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh. Praise be to God." So Satan comes back and talks to God and says, "Well, you know, what if I mess with his health a little bit? People will do anything to spare themselves from pain." And so once again, God says, "Just don't kill him." And so Job finds himself afflicted with this horrendous disease that covers him from head to toe in lesions and sores, scabs. At this point, even his wife stops talking to him. She kind of disappears from the scene. And so he's left sitting on the street corner, scraping his wounds. You know? It's kind of this image, a really external image for perhaps how we find ourselves sometimes just planted somewhere, going over and over the things that hurt us inside, you know? For Job, we see it's very concrete, right? He's lost almost everything that ever meant anything to him, and he has done nothing to bring that on himself. Well, he has some buddies, he has some friends, and they show up and they take a look at him, and they don't even recognize him. This man who was the picture of success and status and wealth is just hardly a wisp of his former self. When they see him there, they're shocked. He's frail, he's weak, he's ill. His eyes, you can imagine, sunk deep from tears wept hour upon hour. And they're left speechless. What's being described, of course, is the physical toll that grief and loss and pain can take on us. Change our appearance, change the way we look, you know? A trauma, a shock. So his friends do the smartest thing that anyone could do that moment. They sit with him in silence for 7 days. They let him be where he is, feeling what he's feeling, and they just enter into that moment with him. They don't try to do anything other than be present with him. Maybe they don't know what to say. That's often the case, of course, when we encounter people or in our own lives when we're trying to make sense of things. But for 7 days, they say nothing. But the silence starts to get the better of them, and they begin to say, "You must have done something to bring this on yourself. There must have been something that you did. So if you could just, you know, be honest about that, figure it out, confess it to God, God will forgive you, and you'll be back on track again." You know? It is a very human way for us to respond when loss happens. We want to understand. We want to believe and be assured that the universe operates in some kind of orderly fashion where good is rewarded with good and bad gets its just desserts. And so they say to him, "Just be honest about what you did to cause this to yourself." But Job is honest, and Job says, "I did nothing. I did nothing. This blindsided my life." And his cry is, "Why?" So when we find him this morning, then, he has been suffering for, 23 chapters already. Suffering with heartache and grief from the loss of his family, suffering from an illness that keeps him in constant pain, and suffering from not being able to make sense or understand why. He will have 19 more chapters to suffer through before he'll see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel. And through those 19 chapters, as, you know, the way the ancient writer has set this up, of course, it begins in a kind of cartoonish way, you know, as I'm telling you. This image of God and Satan having this conversation, making a little bit of a deal. It's the ancient writer's way to frame what is of anything but a cartoonish problem. Why would a good and loving God allow pain and suffering to exist? And so characters come and go and come and go throughout all of Job, the book of Job. And through it all, Job asserts his innocence and wants to know why, if you were so good, God, you would allow this to happen. In that sense, I think Job is our brother. Job is one of us, because I can't believe there's ever been anyone who's made it through life without feeling that way at some point or another. I think he's so appealing, it explains that there's two different towns in the Middle East who claim to be his hometown, and there's three different places that claim to have his tomb. So that connection we feel with Job, powerful. And where we find Job today is just utterly feeling the absence of God. Now I'm going to cut to the end and then just come back and make a few comments. If you were hoping I would tell you why God, a good loving God, allows us to suffer, then you will be disappointed, because I can't answer that question. I wish I had magic words to tell you why. And the fact is that, you know, for this very chapter after chapter, as Job begs God, come down here and fight with me, because this ain't right. It's only when we get to the end that finally God does speak. And if you follow politics at all, you might be familiar with the word filibuster. It's when somebody asks a question, and the person that is to answer the question, rather than answering the question, talks on endlessly about all kinds of other things and runs out the clock. It is precisely what God does. And we have, over the generations, tried to clean that up and tried to kind of make what God says about, oh, where were you when I created everything? And, oh, I'm bigger than you, and I'm stronger, and I'm wiser, and, you know, look at all the great animals. We've tried to make that into some kind of an answer for Job. But in the end, God never really answers Job's question. Why, if you are so good and you love us so much, do you allow us to hurt? God never really answers that question. That sense that there are things that we may never know. There are some experiences that have no rational reason behind them. That's not a problem that we can solve, I think. I think that is a human experience that we simply need to learn to live through. And if we feel that, you know, we have some things we'd like to say to God face to face and God's not there, well, sometimes being surrounded by the image of God will have to be enough. Sometimes cutting out here. If we can't lodge our complaint to God face to face, look to your left and to your right. Because surrounding each one of us are living, breathing human beings made in the image of God. And that's who God has sent. That's who God has sent to help us carry those burdens. We in the church sometimes rush to the happy ending. We say, yes, there's a death, but resurrection comes, you know? God always gets the last word, and that last word is life. And I've said that many times myself, and it is true. But sometimes we are careless with our words, and we try to rush through the real, serious struggles that we endure. And when I've done that to you, I apologize. And I hope we are all mindful that we are called to make some space. Make some space for us to be where we are, feel what we feel, complain about what we need to complain about, and just hold each other. Hold each other in that. Because that's what Christ did. He didn't come here to solve our problems, but he came here to enter our journey and our experiences. So where we might want answers, what God gives us is a journey and a path and a relationship. I will, keep searching, keep asking, keep shaking my fist at God in those moments. As I hope you will as well. And I hope you'll understand that's not outside of the life of faith. That is a part of the life of faith.